The Perils and Promise of the Teenage Brain.
What's so interesting is that the teenage brain, well, it's interesting and it's cautionary, is that the teenage brain, while being so impressionable by good things and can learn so fast, unfortunately, it's more affected by negative things than the adult for that same reason.
That's neurologist Frances Jensen. We talk with her about her book, The Teenage Brain. And marijuana is being used to successfully treat some illnesses and may even be protective against others. But it's not so healthy for the developing brain.
Early regular use of marijuana is associated with up to an 8-point decline in IQ. So clearly, using marijuana at an early age in a regular way is problematic. In addition, it can have worsening anxiety, worsening depression, and for those that have the genes for certain psychotic disorders, early regular use of marijuana, so use in your teens, for example, makes it more likely that you're going to express those genes.
That's addiction psychiatrist Kevin Hill. He tells us about the risks and benefits of pot. His new book is Marijuana, The Unbiased Truth About the World's Most Popular Weed. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us this hour. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon. When neurologist Frances Jensen's two sons hit their teenage years, she was as flummoxed by their impulsive risk-taking and cluelessness about consequences as most parents are when their kids hit that age. But unlike most parents, Jensen could turn her perplexity into a scientific investigation into what really goes on inside the teenage brain. Jensen was then a professor of neurology at Harvard Medical School. She's now chair of the department at the University of Pennsylvania Medical School, and she also worked with patients at Boston Children's and Brigham and Women's Hospitals. She's pulled together all the latest research and her clinical experience in her book, The Teenage Brain, a neuroscientist's survival guide to raising adolescents and young adults. It provides remarkable insights into why teens learn so much better than grown-ups, but also why that makes them more vulnerable to threats like substance abuse, stress, and lack of sleep. Her book clearly explains the science behind teenage behavior. It also gives practical tips for parents and teachers to better understand teens and be more effective in helping them. Frances Jensen, welcome to Writer's Voice. Until recently, the conventional scientific wisdom was that brain growth was almost complete by the time a child reached puberty, but that view has changed. How has it fundamentally changed?
It is the research that is really less than about a decade old, which is showing us that brains are the last organ in your body to reach maturity, and it takes until about your mid-20s. Or even later, and that there's a lot of science now coming out of basic research, like in animal models and experimental, you know, models, but also, more importantly, the advanced imaging, MRI scans, all this new advanced imaging that's hit the, you know, human inquiry world and the clinical world has really started to validate this in people. So it's just the last decade where this news is out. So there's a lot of myths to debunk, and that's one of the reasons why I wrote the book. And also I think that teenagers, you know, are always can be very frustrating or vexing to their parents and teachers and counselors. And I think knowing a little bit about why they're doing what they're doing, that it's sort of an inevitable result of biology, a lot of their behavior, it helps us as their caretakers kind of have more patience around them and count to 10 and have a little bit more understanding and empathy around what is going on in this window. So this is a book not about sort of tips and social psychology, which are very useful. This is more about why the brain is the way it is at this stage and how we can celebrate some of the strengths and really take better advantage of them in this window, but also understand the unique vulnerabilities of teenagers.
Yes, and it's really fascinating from that point of view. I think a lot of people think the changes that happen in adolescence is all about hormones, but it's a lot more than hormones. Give us the overview of some of the major changes in the brain that happen at this time.
Sure. There's two big pieces to this story that, you know, if the listeners just, you know, get these two take-home points, they'll start to understand. The first is that our brains are learning machines. And during childhood and earlier development and adolescence, they are really set to learn at very high rates. Because after all, you're sort of building the scaffold for the rest of your life. And when you learn, actually, your brain cells, which we call neurons, talk to each other through connections called synapses. And these synapses are how one brain cell sends, you know, a signal to another and turns on or off another cell. Well, it turns out that children and adolescents a little less than children, have more synapses than adults do, and they have more of the excitatory, the turning on type of synapses than adults do, and the machinery to build newer synapses. When you learn something, actually what happens, that activity from repeated stimulation and practice of the same sort of circuit in your brain, like when you're trying to learn tennis or you're trying to learn a piano, you know, piece or memorize math, that is actually going through the same circuit over and over again. And once it does that, it actually turns on a process where that synapse gets physically larger and therefore stronger, so that ever after, when you go and turn that circuit on again, the action happens a lot faster. And that's kind of memory. That's memory and talent and skill set, right? So all of those proteins to do that are set by nature at higher levels in childhood. That's why children can learn 2 and 3 languages flawlessly and, you know, seamlessly. And it's still pretty high in adolescence. It's coming down to adult levels. But they can learn much faster than adults, and they should take advantage of this. It's a double-edged sword, and I'll explain that in a minute. But so this is a wonderful time in life. Actually, your IQ, we found research showing that IQs can change in your teen years. A third of people, it stays the same. A third go up, and a third go down. And there's now research to indicate sort of why they might go up and why they might go down, suggesting that this is like a very critical period in your life where you actually have a chance to sort of change your fortunes, if you will, if you work on them. And I think that's big news, because a lot of the education systems and parts of society think, oh, well, you know, that a teenager, you know, they're a scholar or not a scholar at 13 or 14. You're making a call on a person. That is so not right to do. Similarly, socially, if somebody's a bit of a deviant and, say, shoplifts or something, the fact that it's not set in stone who they are at that point in time, that there's a lot of change that can happen all the way through the mid-20s, even into college, and knowing that this wonderful learning time is still present as you enter college and still you have an advantage even when you're leaving college, even at that age. That's part one. Part two is that you have this amazingly active brain, but it doesn't have the ability to connect different brain regions as well to each other as adults do. So what happens is we have different brain regions that have brain cells in them, and they have to connect, you know, from one side of the brain to the other, back to the front. And in order to do that, these brain cells send out processes that reach over across the brain and down to the spinal cord, wherever. There's probably hundreds of miles of these tracks in your brain going every which way, and they have to conduct a signal to be a fast signal. Now, just like a phone wire, a signal goes a lot faster, or electric wire, if it's insulated. And our brains make a natural form of insulation called myelin, which is made by tiny little cells called oligodendrocytes that take literally 2.5 decades to finish the job. They start in the back of the brain and move forward. So that means the last brain area to connect is in the front of your brain. And probably your listeners will smile when I tell you what the frontal lobes and prefrontal cortex does, which is the last to essentially sort of hook up with fast connectivity. Well, frontal lobe is a seat of executive function, empathy, judgment, impulse control, assessment of cause and effect, and of course, this is where teenagers fall behind adults. This is their weakness. They are impulsive and vulnerable because of that. Importantly, the emotional areas of your brain are behind your frontal lobes. They're sort of around where your ears are. They're in places called your limbic system, amygdala, and places like that where sexual desire, hormonal effects can be, you know, felt. And they are actually, because they're back a bit further, they actually get connected earlier than the frontal lobes. So a lot of people have sort of said, you know, a teenage brain is kind of like a Ferrari with weak brakes and with a more emotion that's not being regulated by the frontal lobes. When adults, we can manage our emotions, our reward, you know, our impulses, at, because our frontal lobes are saying, this feels really, really good, but I know it's really, really bad for me, so I'm not going to do it. Teenagers do not have that luxury yet.
You know, it's interesting as you're talking, I'm thinking of the diagnosis ADHD, because that also has to do with executive function. And I've heard that, you know, people with ADHD have Cadillac minds, but, you know, Chevrolet brakes. Is there a kind of connection? And are people, say, with adult ADD just haven't matured? Their brain hasn't matured?
No, it's not as simple as that, actually. And I think, again, the same sort of research that is yielding a lot of information about the teenage brain is really sort of starting to unlock the secrets of what ADD is. I mean, ADD is an interplay between how your brain works and how much distraction you have in your environment. And, of course, in our world, we have an ever-increasing amount of digital distraction invasion of our brains, right? So I think regulating that, it's complex. It's a lot about the ability to attend and focus as much as it is about your frontal lobe saying, I don't want to get distracted by that tempting thing. So it's partially related, but it is definitely not as simple as saying the ADD brain is one with a different, you know, at a different point of maturity.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Frances Jensen. She's a neuroscientist, and we're talking about The Teenage Brain. That's the name of her book, A Neuroscientist's Survival Guide to Raising Adolescents and Young Adults. So now back to the teenage brain. Talk a little bit more about the learning. You know, I find this fascinating that you say that IQ can go up. It also can go down, so I guess that would be the second part of my question, what would make it go down? But talk about how that learning can be, you know, supported and maximized.
Right. So learning in the brain, as I said, is better. It's more efficient in the teenage brain. So don't challenge your teenager to a memory game. You will absolutely lose. They are very, very good at this, as are children, you know, past a certain age. So what we learned is that this process that I was talking about of building a synapse is something we call long-term potentiation. And it means you can study it in slices of brain, experimental brain, where you can, you know, stimulate one cell and record from others on the other side of a synapse and watch how the synapse grows. This has been well studied now as a model of learning and memory. And a lot of the work that I cite in the book talks about the effects of good and bad things on this process. So it turns out that alcohol, cannabis, sleep deprivation, stress are all things that block, put roadblocks in the machinery, in, you know, the steps to make a bigger synapse. Or, you know, there's a number of steps that it proceeds through over, you know, seconds to hours to build this synapse. Well, each of these drugs affects that process at different points and stops it dead in its tracks, so impairs learning. So sleep deprivation can impair learning. Stress, chronic stress can impair learning because of cortisol's effects on the brain. Cannabis can affect learning because it blocks some of the signaling that helps put new proteins up the synapse. And similarly, alcohol. And what's so interesting is that the teenage brain, well, it's interesting and it's cautionary, is that the teenage brain, while being so impressionable by good things and can learn so fast, unfortunately, it's more affected by negative things than the adult for that same reason. A, because they actually have more synapses, and most of these drugs factors affect synapses, but B, because they actually alter subsequent brain damage, because the brain is actively building itself every day in a teenager's head. The brain is like becoming something better than it was the day before. And when you use one of these drugs, it can actually prevent how your brain is going to grow later. So there's a lot of studies looking at the negative effects and the fact that these teenagers are more affected by drugs. Interestingly, addiction, remember I said learning, it's repeated exposure in a pathway, and it actually causes a bigger synapse? Well, really breakthrough science about, you know, in the last decade has shown addiction is simply a form of learning. what happens is instead of a fact or a talent or a motor skill, you're just exposing another circuit in your brain, happens to be in the reward center, to a drug repeatedly. And what happens is your synapses for that drug effect grow, and the reward system for that drug grows faster, harder, longer, stronger than the adult. So they get addicted faster, harder, stronger, longer than the adult, just like they can learn better. So this is an important fact to tell teenagers and to bear in mind, and also helps explain why there's, you know, an epidemic of teen addiction. There has been in other generations too. Look at nicotine, you know, where people have a really hard time quitting if they got addicted during their teen years, to use sort of a, you know, a less illegal example of what you can get addicted to. But mental health and rehab facilities have noticed a huge shift recently in the last decade or so, or even less than the last decade, from sort of the people in mid-adulthood as being their biggest client population to people in their late teens and early 20s suffering and really struggling with addiction. So that is the part of the double-edged sword of, you know, this wonderful strength that the teenage brain has. It also is a unique vulnerability. And I think that's a really important message to get out. And frankly, teenagers and young adults are data-driven. They want information. They want facts. And what I did in this book is I put in real facts. I put in real figures from real papers that I found, and I made, hopefully made them understandable, so that people could say, it's not just because I'm telling you so, because I'm your parent and I'm just crabbing at you. There's a study that shows this. There's a study that shows that. So these are important things to know, and teenagers will listen. We found that teenagers listen better to facts, and there's a lot of facts to back this up.
So what strikes me is that all these things, sleep, stress, drugs, are digital devices, which I'm going to ask you about next. These are also prevalent in our environment. Talk about digital devices, and then I'm going to circle back and ask you, you know, what are some things that we can do to actually, I'm not going to ask you that. We're going to move on. So digital devices, they are ubiquitous and addictive as well.
Right. So that's true. Actually, again, once again, recent science using advanced imaging has shown that the same brain reward systems that we talk about that around addiction for alcohol or, you know, any other addicting substance actually are turned on with video game addiction or gambling. Same thing, same area. It's a reward system. It's that same sort of compulsive behavior that takes hold. And teenagers, as we've just said before, because of their enhanced synaptic plasticity, we call this, actually that building of synapses, we call plasticity because it suggests that the brain is sort of moldable, right, by experience, and that's the term that is used scientifically. But that synaptic learning process, the building of synapses, synaptic plasticity is one and the same as that causes addiction. Same thing as making them better able to memorize facts. So what do we do about it? There's a lot of digital distraction. This actually is something I sort of put into the book, and I want to start a conversation around. I don't think there's a lot of answers, but if you think about it, this teen generation and young adult generation probably has more stimulation coming at their young brains than any other generation, you know, mankind has witnessed. There is more coming at them that is good and bad through social networking, internet, bombarding them. And they have to start to learn how to manage this. And we don't even know how healthy it is to have that much coming at you and how much we might need to, you know, think about downtime and actually, you know, explicitly building it into days. We don't know this, but I can mark my words, there's great research going on right now around that. But we'll probably learn in the next, you know, 4 to 5 years some, you know, hints about how to manage all this. But what about distracted attention and multitasking? Teenagers will tell you, oh, you know, mom, dad, I can do this. You know, I can sit here and learn Shakespeare with the TV on, headphones in my ears, instant messaging on the side of my screen, texting on my phone, music on in the background in my room. Not a problem. I can do this. And, you know, they are better than we are when they're doing that. But I found some studies that looked at people of this generation that have grown up with, you know, this multitasking ability. It's part of their, you know, they've grown up in this digital world, and they still had problems with distracted attention. And what the study did was it took a bunch of early college students and asked them to do a task, and they'd come back each day, and, you know, there was a learning curve. We call it a learning curve. You get better and better every day, and then you can imagine this sort of curve that just sort of goes up and then plateaus when you get the skill. Well, they did this, compared a group that had no distractions to groups that were distracted during encoding, which means when you're laying down the memory, trying to memorize it, or at recall, when you were being tested later, you know. And both of those groups did a lot worse that were distracted at encoding and recall than the purely focused group. And these were young people. So it actually, the distraction during encoding, when you're trying to lay down a memory, turns out to be even worse than during recall. So it's a really bad time to be distracted when you're trying to learn something, because there's too much competing influence. And it means that the brain has its limits as to, you know, what it considers the best conditions to learn under.
You also talk in the book about mental illness, and I was quite surprised to read just how different mental illness is and why it sometimes develops during this period. I wonder if you could talk about that.
Yes. Well, you know, my research, my day job, you know, where I do research, I'm actually also chair of the neurology department at the Perelman School of Medicine at the University of Pennsylvania. So I just recently moved a couple of years down to here, but I still have my research lab, which I've been having for many years, working on how these different stages of brain development, which actually have different types of synapses, different proteins at these different ages, how that affects the kinds of drugs we give or the kinds of treatments we give for a disease. The disease I do look at is epilepsy, for example. And it turns out that a lot of the drugs we use to prevent seizures in adults are working at synapses and types of synapses that aren't even in the child brain yet. So yet we use adult drugs on children. And it's sort of a perfect example of how irrational that approach is. And, of course, they aren't very effective. Big surprise, right? Because there just aren't enough of that particular flavor synapse in the childhood time, but it's prevalent in adulthood. So that's an example of how much we're learning about brain development and how it's going to alter how we think about different treatment patterns for different stages in life. Now, very similar thing happened, and you probably caught it in the news probably 6 or 7 years ago, where they realized that some antidepressants caused, when given at doses that were the right doses for the body weight of the adolescent, similar doses as would be given to an adult of that body weight, cause increased suicidality than in the adolescent. It's kind of a unique side effect, unexpected side effect of these antidepressants, suggesting that these brains are not like adults yet, and you can't make an assumption that you can just hand me down a drug to the adolescent brain even from the adult research. So much more attention is now being given to actually treating adolescents with any kind of brain illness, including mental illness. Now, the interesting thing about mental illness is that, and parents should know this, certainly colleges and universities do, that many of the major affective disorders, bipolar, depression, schizophrenia, come on in late teens and early adult life. This is not just a coincidence that they've left home and suddenly start acting weird, right? It's actually because these brain, remember I said that the brain is sort of connecting from the back to the front and the process doesn't finish. Frontal lobe's not finally connected sort of until your mid-20s. So this process is taking place all the way to the prefrontal and frontal cortex. And it turns out that in order to manifest the signs of schizophrenia or bipolar or other affective disorders, you need your frontal lobes. So that's why it's silent. You don't know the person is going to evolve and have this illness until their frontal lobes start to connect, where it now becomes evident the frontal lobes are built a little differently than everybody else's, and they start to have these symptoms. So there's biology behind that, too. And, you know, you couple that with their increased impulsivity, and this is one of the reasons why people, you know, are concerned about suicides in this age window, because suicides have an impulsive component to them. And, of course, these people don't have the wherewithal to really dampen, you know, some of their impulses. So you combine that with a new onset mental illness, and it's kind of a recipe for that does explain the statistics that we see, you know, in colleges and universities where there's often these, you know, there's a higher a blip in the number of sort of suicides and onset of mental illness.
You're listening to Writer's Voice, and we're talking with neuroscientist Frances Jensen about her book, The Teenage Brain, A Neuroscientist's Survival Guide to Raising Adolescents and Young Adults. We heard Jensen say that doing drugs and alcohol in adolescents, as well as other insults to the brain, can have lifelong impacts. I asked her if there was anything adults can do to undo the damage they inflicted on their brains in their youth. Is the adult brain plastic enough to deal, you know, to kind of heal?
Well, up to a point. The best time to heal it is earlier, and that's why, you know, early childhood, you know, when these, like, cerebral palsy, things like that, you know, that we spend a lot of time doing early enrichment and Head Start programs and things, which are hugely valuable and really can turn things around at that age. But we never, you know, obviously we learn. I mean, I learn, you learn. We learn something new every day. It just takes more effort for the adult brain. But serious rewiring is a bigger challenge in the adult at this point in time. However, there are studies now going on that are looking like, how can we capture whatever that is that's happening in the childhood brain and make it come back, you know, for repair after injury, for, you know, betterment for the aging brain. And that research is, you know, still going on. There's really interesting approaches like with transcranial magnetic stimulation paired with physical therapy where they're kind of giving the brain a boost electrically from magnetic fields where they're trying to see if they can improve plasticity in the adult brain. Again, the more you do, the more you do. And the more you learn, like if you've learned anything in this conversation today, your proteins for learning are all up there now in your synapses, triggered. So it's easier for you to learn something later today than it would have been if you just had a everyday morning and just had your coffee. So the more you do, the more you do. The more you learn, the more you learn. So keeping a very stimulating environment, lots of novelty, that tends to trigger the brain, can really help somebody learn new things at any stage in life. And that's the whole thing about aging brains, for instance. You know how we talk about novel environments and keeping mixing things up for the elderly, because keeping them in the same old boring environment does absolutely the opposite thing. So I think with anybody with, you know, handicap of any kind, the same thing would go. You know, keep stretching them, keep them out there.
So what would be some of your suggestions for parents and teachers? Kind of the attitude that they need to adopt or things that they need to tell themselves when their teenagers might be driving them a little bit crazy. What would you tell parents and teachers?
Yeah, well, that's part of why I wrote the book, because there's a lot of really good information in the book and out there. The research world is trying to tell us, it just doesn't get out to the public very fast, that there's a good reason for some of their behavior. You can't give them you can't excuse it all. But often that what is considered outrageous and highly frustrating behavior and unpredictable behavior that a teen will exhibit at school or at home, a part of it is real biology. And because of that, I think it helps people stand back and sort of count to 10 and go, okay, some of this is absolutely them wanting to be rude or whatever, but the other part is not. You know, there's biology behind this behavior, this impulsivity, or why they sleep late because the circadian clock is set, you know, longer. I mean, it's set later for them. So there's real biology behind behind many of their behaviors. So that's one thing. And the other is to use this information to not always get angry and alienate your teenager and adolescent. I think there's a huge rift that can be created by misunderstanding or jumping to conclusions on the part of the adult around the teenager. And therefore, because the teenagers are certainly not going to be the ones that will, you know, regulate the conversation, it's very likely to escalate into just a nasty situation and like an impasse. And when you do that too many times, you really do start to alienate your teens. And because they need you, you actually as an adult, teacher, or parent, have frontal lobes, last I checked, and could actually give them sort of, I kind of call it a frontal lobe assist. You know, it's like, let's just talk about this another time. Do you realize that this X plus Y equals this other, you know, consequence? And help them think through it. Help them plan a little bit. Stay close enough to them that you're still relevant to them and part of their lives, and try not to be as judgmental as I think is our temptation, because you think of them as adults. They look like adults. You go, "What? Why are you doing this? What are you thinking? How could you do this? How could you get an A on your test and then trash the car the next day? How could you do that? Why would you do that? You know, why do you kids at college take ecstasy when you know it's bad for your brains? Why do you do this? You're so smart. You're A students. It's Ivy League school. Why are you doing this?" I mean, this kind of thing, we can in part explain because of what we know about the biology, but we can also teach them a little bit about where their own strengths and vulnerabilities are and help them realize that they need to mind their brains and they need to realize this is kind of a very critical period in their development where they're scaffolding their brain for the rest of their lives. You're not going to get a lot more brain cells as you get older. Very few areas generate new brain cells. So largely, it's done, and your synapses start to decrease, you know, after adolescence, and you're kind of, the ones you've got are the ones you've got. So you want to build as rich a network as possible for you with your strengths and also work on your weaknesses. And I think that's an approach and a message that parents and teachers should bear as they approach situations with teenagers.
And your book is just a wonderful way to do that. It's The Teenage Brain, A Neuroscientist's Survival Guide to Raising Adolescents and Young Adults. Frances Jensen, thank you so much for talking with us here about this really important topic.
Well, thank you very much. It's great to get a chance to get the word out.
Frances Jensen is professor and chair of the Department of Neurology. She's researched brain development from the neonatal period through adulthood. Jensen received a 2007 Pioneer Award from the National Institutes of Health for her work on the brain. Read an excerpt from The Teenage Brain at writersvoice.net. Next up, how pot affects the teenage brain and more. Stay tuned after the break.
Puff the magic dragon, lived by the sea, and frolicked in land called Honolulu. Little Jackie Paper loved that rascal Puff and brought him strings and sealing wax and other fancy stuff. Oh, Puff the Magic.
Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. When it comes to pot, there's a lot of hype, both pro and con. There's no question that marijuana has an effect on the brain, but is it good or bad? According to our next guest, psychiatrist Kevin Hill, the answer is, it depends. He's director of the Substance Abuse Consultation Service at McLean Hospital near Boston and assistant professor of psychiatry at Harvard Medical School. Hill says that there's a huge gap between the science of marijuana and public perceptions of it. In the past, the dangers of pot were exaggerated, but now they're being downplayed. And young people who are most at risk are the least likely to be aware of those risks. His book is Marijuana, The Unbiased Truth About the World's Most Popular Weed. Well, Kevin Hill, welcome to Writer's Voice. So this book, Marijuana, it was interesting to me that I saw that you have a blurb both from NORML, somebody who's associated with NORML, which is the organization dedicated to making marijuana legal, as well as from others who are like you in the mental health field. You're an addiction psychiatrist at the famous McLean Hospital. Why did you feel this book needed to be written now?
Well, I think it was critical to write it now, largely for two reasons, one from a clinical perspective, the other from a policy perspective. And I think as you alluded to the fact that I have folks on different sides of the issue supporting the book, I think that that underscores the idea that there's a tremendous battle going on over marijuana in the country right now, and there are passionate people on either side of the issue. And I think, unfortunately, what we've seen play out in state after state that are entertaining the ideas of medical marijuana, legalization of marijuana, is that you have the pro-marijuana side who at times relays the message that marijuana is harmless, which is not the case, and they are battling with strongly anti-marijuana folks who at times have been guilty of relaying the message that if you use marijuana, you're doomed, which is also not the case. I think, unfortunately, what happens is these sides get dug in on these issues. There's no compromise taking place, and then we end up having policies that really don't work. And so as a result of that, I think that there are many, many frustrated people, and I think some of those people who are frustrated have clung to the book as a balanced overview on these important issues as a way to potentially move forward. I think if we all understand where the realities are with marijuana, and again, as I alluded to, I think the true answers with marijuana are really in the middle. There are many things about marijuana that are counterintuitive, and so if we embrace the truth about marijuana, I think we're going to be able to make more progress from a policy perspective. And then similarly, I need to embrace those same ideas in my office when I'm seeing patients who have marijuana problems. So if I have a young teenager come in using marijuana every day and I simply hammer them with the negative aspects of marijuana use, what the data is, I'm not going to get anywhere. You know, there's a reason why they're using marijuana daily, oftentimes for extended periods, and I need to understand that, and I need to be balanced and have a risk-benefit conversation with them. And so I think from a policy perspective and a clinical perspective, we really need to understand what the truth is. And right now, there's a tremendous gap between what the truth is and what people hear about marijuana.
So you outline several myths about marijuana. The first myth you've already said, that is it's not harmful. Tell us, what are the harms of marijuana use, and how do you stack them up against the benefits?
Well, I think it's critical to do that. So quite clearly, marijuana can be harmful and it can be addictive. Most people, however, who use marijuana don't have these kind of problems. So about 9% of adult users of marijuana develop addiction, and a simple definition of addiction is repeated use despite harm, and that harm usually takes place in multiple important areas in one's life, such as work, school, or relationships. So about 9% of adults who use marijuana become addicted, about 17% or so of young people. Those numbers are not insignificant, however, when you understand that in the United States last year, about 20 million Americans used marijuana. So we're talking millions of Americans, 2-3 million, are addicted to marijuana. And those are the folks that I see every single day in my private practice or in my consultation service or in the clinical trials that I direct. So quite clearly, if you're using marijuana regularly, there are a host of problems. You can also have problems if you use marijuana today. So if you use marijuana today, it could affect your judgment. It could affect your ability to drive. However, most of the time when people use, they don't have those kind of problems. But you do need to recognize that you can run into difficulties if you use it one time. But as I said, most of the problems are related to chronic use. So most people who come in to see me are using daily, often multiple times a day. And if you're doing that, especially as a young person, so if your brain is developing and that's really 21 and below, if you're using regularly during that time period, it's especially risky. So you can have cognitive difficulties. There have been studies done at McLean and other institutions that show that regular use of marijuana among young people, those people have to recruit different parts of their brain to get the same amount of work done. Similarly, there was an important study that came out in 2012 that showed over time, early regular use of marijuana is associated with up to an 8-point decline in IQ. So clearly, using marijuana at an early age in a regular way is problematic. In addition, it can have worsening anxiety, worsening depression, and for those that have the genes for certain psychotic disorders, such as schizophrenia or schizoaffective disorder or bipolar disorder with psychotic features, early regular use of marijuana, so use in your teens, for example, makes it more likely that you're going to express those genes. Marijuana use doesn't cause those illnesses, but it makes it more likely that you're going to express those genes, unfortunately. And so, as a result, even the pro-marijuana folks, I think, will agree that nobody wants young people using marijuana regularly. So the problems are quite defined among that group. And certainly as adults, you can have some of the same types of problems, particularly those associated with addiction. But I think most people are primarily concerned with youth use of marijuana because that demographic has had an increase in marijuana use over the last several years, along with, importantly, a decreased perception of risk.
So take us down this road a little bit more in detail. Tell us, what is the science, how does it work that regular marijuana use, or even occasional marijuana use, in teens, in youth, can cause brain problems?
So it's actually, the data is very good. So I think that's one thing that sometimes when people want to parry or argue on these issues, they question the science. But I will say this, as someone who, again, is pretty balanced on the issue, that the data is quite good, that if you're using regularly, so daily or nearly every day, as a young person, again, you're going to be needing to use more parts of your brain or different parts of your brain to get the same amount of work done. Unfortunately, so there are receptors in your brain called cannabinoid receptors, and they're all over your body, but primarily in the brain. Over time, if those receptors are continually occupied by delta-9 tetrahydrocannabinol, THC, the main active ingredient that makes you high, eventually you have the lack of development, or there's a process called pruning. I mean, not to get too technical, but more or less, you damage brain cells, let's say. And if you're doing that over time, obviously, at a period of time when you're supposed to be developing cognitive abilities, then you don't develop to your fullest, unfortunately. And that's really what the IQ studies show, that, again, you can lose IQ points. And even if you are someone who stops using marijuana, if you use regularly and you lose those IQ points, you can't get them back. So your brain, unfortunately, doesn't repair itself as well as some other parts of the body. So if you damage brain cells, it's very difficult or impossible, frankly, for them to recover. An important point, though, that you kind of alluded to is that there is some initial research that came out in 2014, last year, from a group from Mass General and also from Northwestern. They did a really nice study where they were looking at MRI images of the brain in young people who are using sporadically, so occasional use once a week, once a month. And they actually showed some structural brain changes in a couple of important regions in the brain. And I don't think that that's a definitive study, necessarily. More work needs to be done. But it actually is an important study because it's the first one that really opens the door to the question of whether or not sporadic marijuana use may change structures in the brain. We're pretty sure that regular use does, as I mentioned, you know, studies published in top journals. But that study that came out last year is a worrisome one because there are a lot of people, obviously, who use occasionally, and so the question becomes, how harmful is that? So that really, I think, in a nutshell, covers how the marijuana habit may impact somebody's ability to think.
You're listening to Writer's Voice, and we're talking with Dr. Kevin Hill about his book, Marijuana, The Unbiased Truth About the World's Most Popular Weed. Humans have been using marijuana for thousands of years, probably, and it doesn't seem like the effects were all that great. I mean, you can compare it to alcohol. You know what happens when you're binging on alcohol. So talk a little bit about the difference between the perception and these studies. How important are the effects?
Well, I think that's you raised several great points. So again, I want to be clear that most people who use marijuana don't have detrimental effects. And I actually am a big believer in the comparison between alcohol and marijuana. I think it's an excellent comparison. I think the fact of the matter is, with both substances, the majority of people who use don't have problems. However, I think an important difference between the two is that as a society, we recognize the dangers of alcohol. So this is prom season right now, for example, and people are talking about ways to limit risk associated with alcohol. We recognize that people can become addicted to alcohol. People can have car accidents related to alcohol use, but we really haven't developed the same types of conversations relative to marijuana. I do think, importantly, that you know, when you compare the relative harms, I would say quite clear that marijuana is not as harmful as alcohol. However, I think it's also important to state, just because it may not be as harmful as alcohol doesn't mean that it can't be dangerous, right? So if you were to add a third substance, heroin, to the conversation, you know, I would say that marijuana is safer than alcohol, and alcohol is safer than heroin. But we all understand, I think, that heroin is very dangerous. Alcohol is also dangerous, but perhaps not as dangerous. So there are different degrees of danger. And I think one of the things that we do in this society is we jump to conclusions. If the commander-in-chief, President Obama, says that marijuana is not as bad as alcohol, I think a lot of people hear the message that, hey, that's safe, it's harmless. And that's not the case. I think, again, we need to be realistic about it. But you're absolutely right. We've used marijuana around the world for over 5,000 years. We have a storied history in the United States. And I think most people recognize that you can use it, quote-unquote, responsibly. And I think that's one of the things that complicates matters when people try to use fear tactics with young people or any groups about marijuana. They tend to lose credibility. Reefer Madness, a famous movie, came out in 1936, I think is a great example. You lose credibility if you're being very outlandish in your claims about what marijuana can do. And as somebody who does a lot of work with schools, I've seen this happen again in schools where I will come into a school and talk to kids frankly about marijuana and its risks, and they've already heard some messages sometimes from people who are really trying to use fear tactics, and they tend to tune those people out. So I think, unfortunately, one of the reasons that we've seen a decline in the perception of risk with marijuana among young people is that we're really not doing a great job educating them about the realities of the drug.
Now, you said before also that there was a link between marijuana and anxiety. I know people who use marijuana to self-medicate their anxiety. So tell us what the link is. You also say that there could be a causal link between the two.
Yeah, no question. So I think that, you know, marijuana and anxiety is a very complicated relationship. It's a fascinating one. I know people who do the same thing. Many of them come into my office, frankly, every day. And so, again, as I said at the top of the show, many things about marijuana are not intuitive. And I think the link between anxiety and marijuana is one of them. So importantly, when you're anxious and you smoke marijuana, you become less anxious. So in the short term, yes, your anxiety level will decrease, much as if someone were to use a medication like Valium or Xanax, one of the benzodiazepines. However, just as with the benzodiazepines, when the medication, in this case marijuana, when it wears off, your baseline level of anxiety, the level of anxiety that you have not under any influence of any substances, actually seesaws back up and will increase. So if you were to draw the curve out, and I do that in my book, we see that over time, using marijuana to treat anxiety, the plant itself, if you're using it to treat anxiety, it doesn't work very well. In fact, your baseline level of anxiety will increase over time. And when you introduce this notion to patients who have tried to use marijuana to treat anxiety, they start to understand that, yes, you know what, when I do use marijuana, I may feel okay, but in general, things are getting worse, it seems. So it's not a good strategy to treat anxiety disorders. However, another facet of it which complicates things even more is that I do believe there's reason to look at certain components, constituents, certain cannabinoids in the marijuana plant. So marijuana, the plant, is made up of over 60 separate pieces or cannabinoids. And I think some of those cannabinoids may ultimately prove to be useful to treat anxiety disorders. So cannabidiol or CBD is one of those cannabinoids that some people who are interested in the topic may have heard or seen on television. And I do think that that one and some other ones may ultimately prove to be useful for anxiety. And so we need more research for that. But clearly, if you're someone who has panic disorder or generalized anxiety disorder, I would not recommend using marijuana to treat that, because there are other treatments that we know are effective, and it doesn't seem that marijuana itself is useful to treat anxiety.
I've also heard that some people are genetically programmed to experience paranoia when they smoke marijuana. Is that something you've also seen?
Oh, no, absolutely. So to do the kind of research that I do, so we run clinical trials to develop medications as treatments for people who are addicted to marijuana. And so we have to jump through a lot of hoops with the government to do these studies. And part of that is because, yes, absolutely, there are some people who react poorly to marijuana and will have a psychotic reaction, will have hallucinations, for example. So it can happen. It doesn't happen very often. But, you know, if you talk to your friends who've used marijuana, there's always one or two people who have had a pretty bad experience with it. And that's that sort of thing that can happen. I mentioned earlier that there is a link between marijuana and psychosis. So anyone who uses really high doses of marijuana may experience hallucinations. But then, as you're kind of alluding to, people that have a genetic background for these kind of disorders are especially at risk for developing disorders. And this is what we see at McLean. We have psychotic disorder units for people who have schizophrenia or bipolar disorder. And once or twice a month, we will see a young person who has never seen a psychiatrist before, who began using marijuana a few months ago, let's say, and then they develop psychotic symptoms such as delusions or hallucinations. And so clearly it is something to be concerned about, that there is a potential for developing that kind of psychotic reaction to using marijuana. But I do want to be clear, the marijuana doesn't cause it. It just makes it more likely that you're going to express it.
You know, it strikes me that, I mean, there are many people who and maybe even there's a growing rate of autism. There's a growing rate of ADHD in this country. You must have seen young people come in who have some of these problems. What is the impact of marijuana on them, or is it any different than with anyone else?
Well, they're at more risk, I think. So one of the things that I talk about with marijuana issues and why it's so critical to get a comprehensive evaluation if you think that marijuana may be a problem for somebody. The idea that marijuana use often doesn't occur in a vacuum. If somebody's using marijuana regularly, daily, nearly every day, they're probably going to have problems in multiple areas, but it's important to kind of tease out how those areas play into their use. So there could be a psychosocial issue going on, could be a relationship problem, school may not be going as well as they would like, or kind of what you alluded to in the question, there may be other untreated or undertreated psychiatric issues that are at play here. It could be depression, could be anxiety. ADHD, for certain, is one that I see frequently. And so the way that that often plays out is somebody will be getting treatment for ADHD or depression, let's say, but it's not working very well. You know, they're taking a medication and the performance has not improved. And at times people don't ask the right questions about marijuana. You know, is marijuana something that is holding back their medicine in this case? So clearly if somebody's using marijuana daily, multiple times a day, you run the risk of having it impair the ability for whether it be a medication or a talk therapy to be effective. So clearly, as I said earlier, that it's very rare that somebody will have a marijuana addiction problem that is all by itself. There usually are other factors going on, and that's why it's critical to address them all at the same time.
So we focused on some of the negative, on the harmful effects of marijuana here. Let's just take a moment for that, though. I also have heard that marijuana can have beneficial effects on the brain. You know, it's cured tumors in rats, although we don't, you know, rats are not people. And I've also heard that it may have a protective effect against Alzheimer's. Could you talk a little bit about some of the positive effects of medical marijuana on the brain itself?
I will. And so, again, I think importantly, it's, you know, you need to point out the fact that kind of what you're alluding to, that there are people who will talk about one side and not the other side. And that's part of the problem here. I think with this debate, we need to talk about both sides. So there are pros and cons to marijuana, certainly. So we did talk about a lot of the cons. In terms of medical marijuana, for me, I think you have to draw a comparison between what kind of data is backed by the gold standard clinical trials, so randomized controlled trials with many, many patients, versus other types of studies. We may have observational studies where you look at a population over time, or you may have animal studies or human lab studies. And so some of the things that you mentioned, the tumor effects or the neuroprotective effects for marijuana in Alzheimer's disease, those are not supported by randomized controlled trials yet. It may ultimately prove to be that way, but there is a lot of exciting research that has been done in Israel and the United States, obviously, that show that marijuana and cannabinoids may be useful in those ways. But I will say this, that there are some medical conditions for which there's very strong evidence, frankly, to support the use of medical marijuana. So we have already two cannabinoids that are FDA approved. And they are, the two cannabinoids are dronabinol or Marinol, people may have heard of before, which is essentially pure THC. There's another medication called Nabilone, which is also a cannabinoid, and they're FDA approved for two reasons. The first one is nausea and vomiting associated with cancer chemotherapy, and the second reason is appetite stimulation in certain wasting illnesses like HIV, for example. And so, again, we have cannabinoids for those two indications. But as I've reviewed the data from the other studies that have been done, I think that the strongest data is really for three medical conditions. The first one is chronic pain. The second one is neuropathic pain, which is a type of burning pain in your nerves that is associated with certain conditions. And then finally, spasticity associated with multiple sclerosis. So for those three conditions, there are multiple randomized controlled trials that have been done that have been quite positive, frankly. And so, in my opinion, it seems quite likely that we will have new cannabinoids approved by the FDA in the next handful of years for one or all of those conditions. Because there are only two cannabinoids approved right now, and there are 60 cannabinoids at least that we talked about earlier, there may be a place for using medical marijuana now. So if you're working with your physician, and you try a first-line treatment for chronic pain or a second-line treatment for chronic pain, they don't work. You know, there may be a point where it makes sense to use medical marijuana.
Finally, then, are you completely against laws that legalize recreational marijuana?
No, I'm not, actually. I'm for legalized recreational marijuana. So, again, many things about marijuana are not intuitive. I think this is one of them. In my view, as somebody who treats addiction every day, I understand it's surprising that some people would not understand why I would be in favor of legalization. I think it comes down to a variety of issues. Number one, in the United States, I think that we should have the ability as adults to decide to do what we want to do to our bodies and with our bodies, as long as it doesn't hurt anybody else. And I think this is a great example. Most people who use marijuana, essentially 9 out of 10 adults who use marijuana, don't have problems. So I don't think you should base policy upon the 10% that have problems. Another key factor is that the majority of Americans want legalized recreational marijuana. So I would rather work very diligently right now to craft policies that work, so giving people what they want, while limiting the risks associated. So again, there are quite a few risks, some of which we talked about today. And so I think it's a tricky area, and we need to do a very careful job thoughtfully crafting policies. And I will say, given the way that medical marijuana and legalization has played out so far in the United States, I think that's a cause for concern, but I would like to believe that we can do a better job if we were to move forward with that in the Commonwealth and other states.
Kevin Hill. His book is Marijuana, the Unbiased Truth About the World's Most Popular Weed. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.